everybody. Welcome to Theater Schmooze, where we chat with Jewish theater makers from around the world about their art, Judaism, and vision for theater's future. I'm your host, Danielle Levski. This podcast is brought to you by the Alliance for Jewish Theater, a nonprofit organization made up of theater artists, theaters, and other people connected to theater to promote the creation, presentation, and preservation of both traditional and non-traditional theatrical endeavors by, for, and about the Jewish experience. Today, we'll be talking with Ben Kaplan, who is a writer and performer based in Halifax, Nova Scotia, in Canada. It is such an honor to have you as a guest in our show today, Ben.
Hello. Pleasure to be with you, Danielle.
Yay. So glad to have you here. I wanted to start off by discussing your piece, Old Stock, A Refugee Love Story. For those who are not familiar with this piece, Old Stock is a music theater hybrid piece inspired by the true tale of two Jewish Romanian refugees finding love after arriving on the shores of Canada in 1908. So this show has been put up in several spaces across North America, Canada, and US for the past few years, including with our member theater, Theater J. Ben, I'd love to learn more about what discoveries you made for yourself as you put the show up across North America. What surprised you in the various productions of it?
I think in a way that the biggest discoveries have actually been the touring of the work outside of North America. Oh. I think touring it around Canada and the US has been, you know, a rich experience. Mm-hmm. But I think that no matter where I've been in Canada or in the United States, there is a certain immediacy that I think is very present to the work because everybody in North America is an immigrant, with the exception of First Nations and Indigenous peoples. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that there is a sort of immediacy to the relationship to, you know, the idea of having great grandparents that come from somewhere else. And I think that no matter where people's, you know, ancestors may have come from, whether it was, you know, on the Mayflower or just, you know, a decade ago from somewhere else.
Sure. Yeah.
I think that I could feel, and I could, you know, was getting feedback from audiences afterwards about the resonance of, you know, people coming from, you know, East Indian descent, talking about, you know, how they saw their own grandparents in the story and those kinds of things. What was interesting for me was taking it to Australia in 2019. Mm-hmm. And feeling how in that context, and I would say it to a certain degree in the United States as well, it sort of carried much more of a political charge. And, I, you know, in Australia, the context there was they were in the midst of a big public debate around shipping migrants to this sort of penal island.
Right.
So I think that context shifted it a lot. And then it was very interesting feeling the difference of how the show played in the Netherlands and in England, where that, mm-hmm. that shared, you know, reference point of having an ancestor that came from somewhere else wasn't necessarily shared. Although I think that because of that, it seemed like people in the audience who did identify as being immigrants or the grandchildren or children of immigrants seemed like there was this absence of public discourse around the emotional and practical experience of that, that I think was therefore even more important to be sparking those conversations in those places.
Wow, interesting. Can you recall any of those specific conversations, especially outside the US, that were particularly interesting to you?
Yeah, it's sort of like vague snapshots and mirages, which is mostly how my memory works. But I certainly in particular recall we did a long run, maybe 3 or 4 weeks in London. And there was a number of conversations, like just to leave the theater, you had to exit through the bar, which is a fun thing. Mm-hmm. And so there was a higher volume of post-show conversations than might necessarily happen in other venues. And so there was a lot of people who I recall coming up to me and saying, like, this is my story or my great grandparents' story, and not necessarily people from Jewish backgrounds, mm-hmm. but people saying, like, I feel seen, I feel witnessed, and I feel like, you know, these are conversations that we don't like to have in English society.
Oh, wow. Right. Because it's so much more present here, as you said, in North America. So many of us are immigrants or have family that are immigrants.
Yeah, I think the discourse is present at all times, and people mm-hmm. pick, you know, positions relative to the discourse, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. but the discourse is ever present. And in the UK, it's like a different thing. And in the Netherlands, even more so. I mean, the Netherlands, the Dutch have a violent colonial history, just like most Western European countries. But they still have a very ethnic sense of what Dutchness looks like and is. So, you know, it was interesting to confront. I mean, I think the central question of the show in many ways is what does it mean to take on a new identity? What does it mean to become a Canadian? What does it mean to be American? And the show sort of emerges, the idea for the show emerges out of Canadian political debate in 2015. There was a national leadership debate, and our former Prime Minister Stephen Harper made a comment during that debate making a distinction between sort of new arrivals with, you know, potentially spurious refugee claims, contrasted against what he referred to as old stock Canadians. And so it raised the question in my own mind, and I think in many people's minds, where does that dividing line begin? And how am I supposed to identify as the audience listening to this rhetoric? Am I supposed to think of myself as an old stock Canadian because I'm third generation and white presenting? Or am I on the wrong side of that line? And, you know, I suspect that the Right Honorable Mr. Harper was expecting me to identify with you know, the old stockness. But to me, it sounded like a dog whistle that you know, illustrated how difficult it is to make that distinction for anybody. You know, is it two generations? Is it five? Is it seven?
Yeah.
Do you have to be a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant to qualify as old stock? Or what exactly does that mean in your mind, Mr. Harper? And so, you know, wrestling with that question, and how do I identify and what does that mean was sort of the jumping off point for the work.
That's really profound, and actually is a wonderful jumping off point to another question I had, which is, what is your personal relationship to immigration and Jewish diaspora? You said you're multiple generations back, your family came to Canada, but what does it mean to you to identify with these concepts?
Yeah, I think that moment in 2015 during the leadership debate was certainly a palpable moment of forcing me to reckon with those questions in a way that I hadn't in the same way before. I don't know if I have a clean and clear answer to that question. It's sort of a bit of a fuzzy mess. And I think that's the natural state of things with that. I mean, you know, I don't identify as an immigrant, but I also am aware of my identity as a settler in this land. And I think that in Canada in particular, we're having a lot of conversations around what that means and what decolonization may look and feel like. And so, you know, I think that despite the profound persecution that Jews have had to endure over the centuries, there's still a profound difference between somebody who is coming from, you know, a Western European or you know, in the case of my family, still Eastern European, but you know, a background that prioritizes literacy and modes of engagement with the dominant culture that set one up for success. And I think that there are many other ways of knowing, many other ways of seeing and thinking and doing that are not necessarily as privileged within the structures of our society. And I think that we can talk about ways of knowing and ways of learning and ways of transmission that are optimized for the culture that we live in. But I think that there's a sort of a growing awareness that other ways of knowing and transmitting intergenerational knowledge and these kinds of things are not necessarily better or worse, but just are better suited for different cultures, environments, and contexts. So, you know, I try to sort of check my privilege in coming from this kind of background to be aware of the contexts in which, you know, my appearance and my cultural background are given certain preferences in a lot of different contexts.
Yeah, definitely. And very well said too, I think, in terms of the modes of communication and learning and information sharing, despite the Jewish diaspora suffering quite a bit and going through so many changes and immigrations and escapes in our history, we are the people of the book. And it's very convenient that the way the world operates, the Western world, is through writing, through explanation that's very, very similar to the way that Jews dissect their information. That's really well put.
Yeah, it feels like, you know, we may have leaked some cultural wisdom into the mainstream that has given us places of privilege. because we happen to have a long cultural tradition of using those same techniques. And, you know, and I think that, you know, being the descendant of slaves 3,000 years ago is a very different thing from being the descendant of slaves, you know, for 150 years ago.
Of course.
People talk about slavery in the United States and in Canada as if it happened 500 years ago, but that's just when it began. I mean, there are people alive today who met their great grandparents and grandparents who experienced chattel slavery in the first person. So that's, you know, we still have people alive today who knew their relatives who experienced that. So it's a lot closer than people like to imagine.
Yeah, of course. So all of these ideas around identity and your personal relationship to your family's background, but also to your experience currently as a settler, as a white presenting person, et cetera. What does that mean for you as a Jewish artist? Like, how do you present yourself in the world as a Jewish musician, performer, and how does that manifest?
It's an interesting question. I feel like my Jewishness has, you know, crept into my bio and my, you know, public facing self-description more over the last few years. I think that for a long time, my Jewishness was very much implicit and not necessarily always explicit in terms of how I was being described in these kinds of things. And I think, you know, a part of that was self-consciously wanting to avoid being pigeonholed. I know a lot of really talented artists who can't seem to get a gig outside of JCCs and Jewish cultural events. And I didn't want to be a Jewish performer for Jews. I wanted to be a person who was trying to engage with the world of art and culture and music and performance in these kinds of ways by bringing my full self to the table, which, you know, incidentally includes a pretty large spoonful of Jewishness without, you know, putting that in the first line of any sort of description. But I think that, you know, from the kinds of melodies that I'm drawn to, the kinds of subject matter that I'm drawn to, the ways in which I engage with questions in my songs, I think are all very Jewish things. And so it's never really very far from the surface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. We've had a lot of our guests in the past also talk about this idea of not wanting to be pigeonholed as a Jewish artist of any kind, but also finding it almost impossible to untangle their identity from Jewishness, because as you said, we were raised with that type of knowledge, that type of experience, that type of exposure. It's going to make its way in.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's about authenticity. And I think to leave that over here would not be authentic. It's about, you know, trying to bring the full palette, or like a palette is fine, but maybe it's, you know, identity is kind of like a rope made of many threads. And I don't know if I would feel as confident about the knots I was trying to tie if that thread of Judaism was absent from my rope.
Oh, that is so beautifully said. That should be a quote on a t-shirt or something. Very nice. Actually, also a great segue. What kinds of threads do you find between music and theater making? You're a musician, but you're also a performer. What are some of the similar processes you find between those two art forms?
Yeah, I mean, my experience on stage really started in the theater, and I was interested in theater before I was interested in you know, I guess I was always very interested in music, but the way in which I sort of discovered a mode of exploring music was through musical theater and those kinds of things. And you know, I had a little guitar and would strum away at home, but it was really in musical theater training and musical theater experiences that I began to cut my teeth on stage. Mm-hmm. And then there kind of came a moment in my early 20s where I was juggling my burgeoning career as a singer-songwriter and my academic life and the theater commitments that I had made. And I realized that something had to give. And I was trying to imagine like how to make a career in theater. And I saw how many people are required to put together a decent production. I mean, even a one-man show or a one-person show, you're going to want a sound technician and a stage manager in an ideal world. And heck, maybe somebody to produce the thing if you're not doing everything your gosh darn self. And a director and lighting design and all of this stuff. And it's like, gosh, you got to rely on so many talented, brilliant people showing up, bringing them full selves and working for next to nothing in the early days that I just thought, I can't see a way of doing it without just being lucky. I can't see a way of like manifesting this for myself. Whereas music was like, oh yeah, I can just like write the tunes and show up and then play them. And then I've got a show and I don't really need anybody else to tell me that I can or cannot do it. I'll book a venue for one night. They'll provide a sound technician. But anyway, so that was sort of how I fell into a career as a singer-songwriter. And I was kind of invited back into the theater, you know, a decade after I'd stepped away now as a professional. And so, you know, my experience of theater making versus songwriting, you know, for one thing, it's a heck of a lot more collaborative. And I really enjoyed that part of the thing. It was really nice siloing myself off for a decade to like not rely on anybody else, but to have, you know, brilliant collaborators to lean on was maybe my favorite part of the whole theater making process.
Yeah.
What was the question?
I think you sort of explored the differences between them, which are quite like stark and interesting. I think from a logical perspective, most of us know that theater takes a lot of people to make a show happen. And music can be a very solitary practice, but I like the way you described it and talked about your own process and decisions for what had to give in that moment when you were taking on too many things. I guess I'm curious, now that you've found your way back into the performance and theater world and you're enjoying this collaborative element, do you see yourself bringing some of that back into your music making? Like, is there a way to make music a more collaborative process for you?
Absolutely, yeah. So I think that for one thing, it's certainly informed, you know, being a little bit more open to collaborative risk in the creation phase. And beyond that, I think that it has, you know, stepping back into the theater world as a much more experienced adult, you know, performer, entertainer, you know, I'm looking at the role of lighting design and stage design and these kinds of things with just a slightly more informed and curious perspective, and seeing the way like all of these things are choices that are being made in the world of live music performance. And, you know, sometimes the choice that's being made is to not make a choice. And there's good reasons for not making a choice. Maybe you don't have a lighting designer or a budget to bring your own shit. So you're going to, the choice is to rely on whatever the sound technician and his six par cans and LED things behind you is going to do. And that's the choice. And that's usually the choice that is available on a given night. But, you know, sort of being aware of the ways in which those things can change a show. Yeah, certainly opens up a lot of interesting avenues in the future.
Definitely. And we see that a lot with musical artists, you know, some very bare bones stage, instruments, sound, that's about it. But the ones that include this performative element where it's a joy to watch what's happening behind, in front of, and maybe even to the performers, musicians themselves. It can really elevate the experience of watching a live show.
Yeah, and there's something, there's the Pink Floyd light show, or like, you know, going to see Fish or something like that, where they're just like huge, expansive, whatever. But it's not engaged in storytelling. It's just doing something visually interesting, which is wonderful and adds a whole other level. But I also think that there are opportunities for storytelling with light and with the use of space that can achieve subtle and beautiful things. And I kind of like the effects that can be achieved without showing your hand to the audience, things that happen so subtly that people aren't necessarily aware that they're being manipulated. I like, you know, secretly manipulating the people with the tools of the theater.
Yeah, of course. So you have a recent musical album, Recollection. Do you think that you'll be using some of these either secret or not so secret elements in the performances of this album?
Yeah, I think that, you know, in terms of like lighting design, stage design, you know, I'm not touring right now with my own crew, so those things are pretty limited. But I think the way in which I treat the dynamic of sound has been influenced by this experience of touring and working on old stock. You know, I think that it's very easy to be tempted to like want to like show the audience 10 is really exciting, but like 0 and 1 are also really exciting. And I think that, the last few years of doing this work in theater and the brilliant direction of Christian Barry, who directed and co-created Old Stock, you know, living that show and living those dynamics has, I think, brought a lot more of a sense of playfulness around dynamic.
Wonderful. Oh, that's really, really cool. And I guess I'd like to know more with recollection. What stories inspire these songs that we might eventually see appearing in Tidbits on stage?
Well, I mean, if you say that we might be seeing in Tidbits on stage, I don't know if there's any threads on that album that I'm thinking about necessarily going in a theatrical direction with. You know, those songs come from a lot of different places. Some are, you know, experiences of the heart, and some are experiences of the mind. Mm. But yeah, I think they come from different places. But I am interested in working on another theater project, and I'm actually slowly starting to engage with that process. We've got, you know, the creative team that built Old Stock is being sniffed after for something larger. And so we've got a little bit of dough set aside for some creation time and some workshopping and some writing. So that's stuff that's, you know, scheduled to be in process in mid to late 2023.
Oh, mid to late 2023. That's coming up. Can you give us a little sneak peek on what that story might be about?
Yeah, I can tell you the vague outline of what the story might be about. So in the 1930s in New York City, there was quite an active neo-Nazi, or not neo-Nazi, they were just Nazis, nothing neo about them. There was a pretty active Nazi party going on in the United States in the 1930s. And you may have even seen images from rallies at Madison Square Garden. There's some pretty disturbing imagery. And there's stories about some of the members of the Jewish mafia called Murder, Inc., which was the name of the largest Jewish mafia in New York City, was often used as the enforcement arm for the Italian mob. They would get the Jews to do their dirty work, which often involved throwing people out of windows. That was the number one Murder, Inc. way of dealing with taking out the trash, was defenestration, which is one of my favorite words. I can't believe they have a specific word for throwing somebody out of a window. So there's the story that one of the head rabbis of New York City, and I couldn't tell you more than that, apparently called in one of the mob bosses, and whose name I'm forgetting right now, and basically called in a hit of some Nazis. And there's this question around, when is it okay to punch a Nazi in the face? And when is it okay to meet violence with violence? And is it okay to meet the threat of violence with violence? Is it okay to meet something that is the call for your existential end to be met with violence? Or is that crossing the line? Is firing the first shot the problem? And so working on a show, thinking through what it means to be a Jewish person in a Jewish community, like the rich ones found in New York City, being forced to grapple with threats of violence at the same time that actual violence is happening over in Europe, and the stories are starting to get out. So I think that there's a lot of interesting stuff to think about from a theological standpoint, which is interesting to me, as well as from a social and political standpoint. But also from a human standpoint. I think, you know, one of the first songs that I'm working on for that thing is a song sung by the mother of a defenestrated Nazi, because everybody's got a mom.
Everyone's got a mom.
And nothing is black and white. And I think that it's very tempting in this day and age to tell black and white stories. And I am not interested in that. I'm interested in moral quagmires and dilemmas and all of the gray spaces that we are eternally forced to confront.
I was actually, as you were explaining this story, I had flashbacks sitting around a Shabbat table discussing the big moral question of the week. It was usually some kind of moral conundrum. And there was one that was very similar, which was like, if there is the threat of you and your family to be possibly, you know, defenestrated or some other way of getting rid of people, what do you do? Do you defend yourself actively, physically, violently? Do you let it happen? Like, there was a whole discussion about that.
Well, according to the Talmudists, if you have a pursuer, I forget the Talmudic language there, but a pursuer, somebody coming after you, you actually have an obligation to defend yourself. And it opens up an interesting question around, you know, does that Talmudic phrase apply to abortion? If the health of the mother is in threat by the fetus, or even if her mental health is in threat, or if her social well-being is in threat, you know, is a fetus rightly considered through the categories of the Talmudists to be a pursuer? And are you therefore obligated to take action to defend yourself?
Wow.
And yeah, on that subject, there's a synagogue in South Florida who's just filed a lawsuit against the state on religious grounds for denying access to abortion. And I'm fairly confident that it's that Talmudic bit that is being used as sort of the groundwork for the case.
I think I have read something about this. Yes. Well, if we're going to use religion in that way, thank God. that's really interesting. I'm impressed with your ability to take very true stories set in a part of history that's often been, I don't want to say recycled, but there's a lot that's written about the Holocaust, a lot that's written about Nazis, a lot that's written about Eastern European refugees. And it's really interesting how you find these threads that are very unique within them to explore in your storytelling.
Yeah, I'm curious about the confusing bits, the morally ambivalent parts. Mm-hmm. You know, the director of Oldstock asked for a love song. He said, "We got to write a love song for these two, mm-hmm. our two protagonists." And I was really, really struggling with that one because I wasn't sure if they loved each other. And so, or like, you know, what does that mean? It's sort of like, and for people who haven't seen Oldstock or are familiar with the work, there's sort of like there's a bit of an ambivalence involved in the arrangement of our male and female protagonists winding up together. And, you know, a lot of it is circumstance and it's not an easy path for them. And so, you know, the love song that I wound up writing was a song called What Love Can Heartbreak Allow, which is this song that is done with a canon. It would be the musical term for it, where there's one musical line that gets given. And then the, sort of the next musical line emerges as a counterpoint over it. So the lyrics continue to be sung from the previous verse while the new melody for the next verse comes through. And it creates this tangle of narratives and stories that it's. You have to listen to it a few times to like hear the specific word of every verse. And I think in many ways, that's what love is. It's these complicated and conflicting experiences of desire to be seen and to be loved, but also to be witnessed and to be known. And we also carry our traumas and our defense mechanisms and all of our shielding that we've developed through this life with us into each relationship. And so, you know, to me, the question of like, can we love each other is much more interesting than do we love each other?
Wow. That's a very, very minute distinction and really interesting. Yeah. Thank you, Ben. Yeah, this has been such a fascinating conversation.
Well, it was truly a pleasure to speak with you.
Yeah. Thank you for joining us. Truly. What a great conversation we had today. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to Theater Schmooze. A special thanks to Danny Debner, our technical producer, Ilya Levinson and Alex Kaufman, the composers of our theme music, Michelle Shapiro, the creator of our logo, and the entire Alliance for Jewish Theater community. This podcast was brought to you by the Alliance for Jewish Theater. If you like what you've heard today, support this podcast and all of our initiatives towards connecting Jewish theater makers by making a tax-deductible donation to Alliance for Jewish Theater at alljewishtheater.org. or joining as a member. Make sure to give us a review on iTunes and learn more about us on our website. I'm your host, Danielle Levski, and I'll chat with you next time. L'chaim.
L'chaim.